En podcast från Aftonbladet.
Avsnittet presenteras av... Stödlinjen.se, åldersgräns 18 år.
Argentinas högerextrema president Javier Milei vill såga sönder staten med en motorsåg. Han hyllar maffiabossen Al Capone som en hjälte och han har kallat klimatförändringen en socialistisk konspiration. Hans hårdhänta politik har inspirerat högern över hela världen, från Elon Musk i USA till Timbro i Sverige. Idag ska vi titta närmare på det argentinska exemplet och på högerns guldgosse Javier Milei. I dagens avsnitt av Starta pressarna, en podd om ekonomi och politik från Aftonbladets ledarsida med mig, Daniel Suhonen. Ja, välkommen ni som lyssnar och välkommen Max Järnek, min kollega här till studion.
Hej.
Sommaren dånade där ute och idag ska vi prata om det här argentinska, är det ett mirakel eller ett under eller en katastrof? Det ska vi reda ut. Och deras ökände president Javier Milei. Max, kan du säga, vem är den här Javier Milei egentligen?
Han är en ganska excentrisk typ. Han dels ser han ut ungefär som Wolverine.
Han har bra hår.
Han har bra hår, det har han.
Det är lite Martin Ådahl, lite Martin Ådahl kalufs där alltså.
Ja, nej, han har en väldigt bra look och han har också en väldigt extravagant framtoning. Han brukar posera med en stor motorsåg som han säger vilja såga sönder staten med. Vilket inspirerat Elon Musk också, hans så kallade Doge-projekt. Så att han är libertarian, han är extremt långt ut på högerkanten. Han vill i princip inte ha någon som helst stat alls förutom militär och polis. Och han vill skala bort allting annat. Och han vann presidentvalet i Argentina slutet av 2023. Ganska oväntat från början. Men sen så i takt med att inflationen steg så steg också hans popularitet. För det var hans stora val efter att äntligen få bukt med den här inflationen som har plågat Argentina sedan 80-talet i princip. Kanske ännu längre tillbaka. Så han är president i Argentina. Och har inspirerat folk även utanför Argentina. Har fått stor uppmärksamhet. Som jag nämnde, Elon Musk, Donald Trump gillar honom. Här i Sverige så har Timbro skrivit en rapport om Milei som gillar honom. Och han ses som en stor förebild av många på någon som kommer in och skalar bort allt onödigt som staten håller på med. Och bryter den här onda spiralen som skapar inflation och kaos och får ordning på landet. Hans politik är på något sätt större än bara Argentinas politik.
Är han, kan man säga, det är väl ganska ovanligt att den här typen av extrema liberaler får regeringsmakt. För den strömningen finns ju inte minst i USA. Liksom, det finns ju människor som är libertarianer.
Mm.
Men det är ganska ovanligt att väljarna ger dem som vill montera ner staten och ta bort. Henrik Jönsson till exempel är en person som jag ofta möter i olika sammanhang som debattör. Och vi har trevliga samtal i kvartal och sådär. Och han kallar sig libertarian. Men han är ju från en svensk perspektiv. Men det är ganska ovanligt att de här personerna får väldigt mycket makt. Vad tänker du om det? Det är, liksom är det risk att det finns spridningseffekter? Att vi får fler såna här Milei-typer som vi ska prata nu om vad han står för och vad han gör?
Mm. Han påminner lite om Bolsonaro i Brasilien. Och anledningen till att han vann valet var just att det var en så pass djup och stor kris i Argentina. De har haft en eskalerande inflation. Och man brukar räkna inflationen månadsvis istället för årsvis för att den är så hög där. Och i sådana lägen så blir folk desperater och vill prova någonting nytt. Och han lyckades locka väljare som bara vill testa någonting radikalt nytt. Sen är frågan hur radikalt nytt det verkligen är. För många av hans rådgivare är sådana som tidigare har varit rådgivare till tidigare regeringar i Argentina.
Om man börjar liksom ändå... Vad är det liksom, vad beror den här extrema? För att jag var nu är det 10 år sedan jag var i Argentina på semester. Och redan då, det har ju som du säger sedan 80-talet. Och det är ju verkligen, det är siffror som man inte kan tänka sig. Det är sådana här, liksom bananrepublik-siffror. Alltså pengarna är ju, den inhemska valutan, man måste ju använda dollar om man är turist. Om man ska liksom betala för saker, du måste ju använda det och sen växla över. Växelkursen är ju ett skämt och så vidare. Och det finns en svarta börsmarknad, fanns det då i alla fall. Men vad beror själva inflationen på? Det har jag egentligen aldrig förstått. Vad är det liksom som driver inflationen i Argentina? Är det liksom att de är inne i ett ekorrhjul? De är inne i det här som Milton Friedman varnade om, att att man räknar med att nästa år är 20, eller nästa vecka är det 20% dyrare, så då måste jag ta ut 20, alltså är det en sån löneprisspiral eller en prisspiral bara? Vad är det som det beror på?
Jag har intervjuat en expert som går in lite mer på det, men i grund och botten handlar det om att, skulle jag säga, att Argentina har varit ett ganska rikt land för länge sedan och byggt upp en viss levnadsstandard för folk, och sen så har läget försämrats, men man har ändå haft vissa förväntningar på att staten ska leverera vissa saker. Så att trots att ekonomin har krympt och man har en väldigt, väldigt smal ekonomi som är beroende av råvaruexport, man har försökt industrialisera, inte lyckats särskilt bra, så att man har en väldigt smal bas av ekonomin, och då blir det väldigt, då är man väldigt utlämnad åt fluktuationer på världsmarknaden, och som du sa, man behöver dollar, det är det de saknar.
Och de har sådana utlandslån, för att jag kommer, det var väl någon kris där på, är det tidigt 00-tal eller 90-tal, när de typ nästan ställde in betalningen och sådär, för att det är den här, de har också den här liksom populist-vänster-mitten-traditionen liksom, som ibland är höger, att de här, vad heter de nu, peronisterna, som ju liksom är någon sorts populiströrelse som ibland lutar vänster och ibland lutar höger, men liksom, ja, nej, men det är ett spännande land, just det här att det, liksom, går man runt där så är det så här byggnader från 1800-talet som är liksom, slår Paris nästan.
Mm.
Och så samtidigt har de säljer fortfarande, liksom, det är mycket jordbruksexport liksom, som ju då på 1800-talet var, då kunde man bygga ett rikt land på att sälja liksom, nötkött till Europa och USA.
Mm.
Och det bärs inte, idag är det andra produkter som ger välstånd.
Ja, precis. Så att de har fastnat i det här beroendet av sin jordbrukssektor, kan man säga. I vissa lägen så har man försökt knyta växelkursen till dollarn, och sen så har det lett till kaos, och det som ledde till kaos då tidigt 2000-tal. Ja, så de har liksom stapplat från kris till kris sedan 80-talet. Och som du sa, i grund och botten så handlar det om att de har en väldigt, väldigt stor utlandsskuld i dollar som de inte kan betala, så att de får nya lån från IMF. De är väl inne på kanske 23:e lånet eller något sånt nu från IMF. De får nya lån för att betala av gamla lån i dollar. Så att de kommer aldrig ur den här skuldfällan.
Så de skulle behöva en skuldsanering, alltså bli av med hälften eller alltihopa och så börja på, från scratch då, med något sorts liksom, ja, ett nytt blad.
Ja, kan man säga.
Men om man, alltså just nu vi spelar in det här så är det ju, det händer ju spännande saker just nu i Argentina. Den tidigare presidenten Kirchner har precis blivit gripen. Kan du berätta något om det?
Ja, precis. Jag såg det nu häromdagen, att hon har blivit arresterad, anklagad för korruption. Och det påminner väldigt mycket vad som hände i Brasilien. Att högern där, de drev en kampanj mot, först mot president Lula, alltså vänsterpresidenten som satt tidigt 2000-tal. Och fick honom arresterad. Och sen så drev de en kampanj mot hans efterträdare Dilma Rousseff.
Som var folkvald president då?
Ja, precis. Så att de fick bort både Lula och sen Rousseff med sin anklagelse. Och sen så kom Bolsonaro så småningom över, som också är en Milei-liknande karaktär. Väldigt kontroversiell, väldigt frispråkig och väldigt, väldigt långt åt höger.
Och han är ju nästan fascist, och han är ju nu då, riskerar 40 år fängelse för den här statskuppen som han då nästan, när han förlorade valet. Så att det går ju en tråd här från det som händer i USA, alltså Argentina och Brasilien och USA är på något sätt i någon sorts, deras höger är på något sätt i någon sorts, de är lite olika stadier, lite olika, de testar olika metoder på något sätt för att hålla sig kvar vid makten. Donald Trump med sin stormning av liksom Kapitolium 2021, och sen har man situationen då med den här statskuppen mot Dilma Rousseff, och sen liksom försöket att få bort Lula som kandidat. Det lyckades ju då dess bättre inte. Jag tycker personligen att Lula är en väldigt stor arbetarledare, en väldigt stor demokrat som liksom demokratiserat Brasilien. Men liksom ett försök till statskupp med oschyssta medel, just om korruption.
Mm.
Och sen, och det finns säkert korruption. Det hela det brasilianska systemet är i princip att du köper dina parlamentariker för att få majoritet i riksdagen. Så det är liksom, det är ett korrupt system. Det är ingenting att snacka om. Det är förmodligen inte så att Arbetarpartiet är mer korrupt än högern. Utan det är liksom fel på hela systemet. Men, och sen har man då det som händer nu i Argentina. Där man liksom har en annan, han har ju inte gjort något odemokratiskt, han har ju vunnit ett val. Men han går ju väldigt hårt fram med staten. Som ni ska prata om i intervjun som kommer alldeles strax här.
Mm.
Ser du också de här kopplingarna? Liksom, det är som en våg av olika liksom, högerkrafter som är ganska, alltså Trump, Bolsonaro och Milei är ju ganska lika varandra.
Ja, precis.
I det här liksom, företagare, rika män, väldigt liksom excentriska, storvulna som du är inne på, extremt höger.
De presenterar sig som outsiders, som är utanför det politiska systemet, som säger att de kan gå in och fixa det, även om de egentligen är ganska, har ganska stora kopplingar till etablissemanget. Och Bolsonaro försökte göra samma sak som Trump, alltså Trumps farsartade kupp 6 januari efter att han hade blivit bortvald, så alltså försökte han stanna kvar vid makten. Och sen försökte Bolsonaro göra samma sak som var kanske ännu mer farsartad än Trumps försök. Så att jag tror Bolsonaro nu sitter inne. Men det påminner ju väldigt mycket om den utvecklingen, så vi får se vad som händer i Argentina.
Ja, det är väldigt obehagligt och väldigt viktigt att också liksom ha koll på vad som händer. Men så här, alltså Javier Milei är väldigt populär, och jag kommer att när du började prata om att göra ett avsnitt om det här, när vi hade liksom möte här för ett tag sedan, då var det som det här att Timbro hade liksom plockat upp och liksom hjälteförklarat Milei, alltså hans politik. Och du såg att det fanns liksom brister i den där argumentationen, att den kanske var felaktig då. Kan du berätta om det?
Ja, det var lite intressant. När jag gjorde research till avsnittet så läste jag en rapport som Timbro har gett ut om Javier Milei. Kommer Milei att lyckas, heter den. Och där hittade jag ett diagram som jag tyckte var väldigt konstigt. Och som jag frågade den här professorn som jag intervjuade, som vi ska lyssna på sen, Mattias Vernengo. För det var ett diagram över reallönerna i Argentina före och efter Milei. Och så ser man att de i slutet av 2023, då kollapsar de. Och sen så finns det en...
Det är en bra situation för en president att bli vald.
Ja, precis.
Att göra uppror mot det här liksom kaoset.
Ja, men det första Milei gjorde när han kom in var att devalvera peson, den argentinska peson, med 50%.
50%?
Ja, så att de gick från att peson kostade $400 för en dollar till 800. Det var det första han gjorde i ett slag. Och då kollapsade reallönerna liksom, såklart. Men i det här diagrammet som Timbro har i sin rapport så visar de en sträckad linje som ska vara Mileis tid vid makten, att den börjar efter det här raset. Så att det ser ut som att Milei kommer in på botten och att han sen kan höja reallönerna efter det. Så att den här kollapsen hamnar liksom på den förra presidenten, så att det ser väldigt bra ut för Milei i den här rapporten. Och jag frågade den här professorn om det och han sa, jag vet inte vad de har gjort här, men det här stämmer verkligen inte, utan det här raset som syns på grafen, det är när peson devalverades.
Så det är Mileis fel så att säga.
Ja, alltså det Milei gjorde var att han devalverade valutan, reallönerna sjönk ihop och sen så har de sakta börjat öka efter det. Men Timbro har en graf som visar bara den här ökningen. Så det är väldigt ohederligt.
Det är lite så här, det verkar vara högerns nya grej det här med liksom hur man drar, alltså hur man tidsanger olika epoker och så. Det verkar ju vara, vi har haft en diskussion med Lars Jonung här som pågår. Det är liksom ett trauma i livet här. För han gjorde Wigforss, hela tiden som Wigforss var minister så var det liberalism liksom. Och sen så blev det plötsligt socialism liksom när det började gå åt helvete. Mm. Alltså det här att liksom, det är någonting intressant. Det är inte ämnet för dagens podd, men det är intressant. Liksom, jag tror att den som skulle komma till mig, jag är chef på Katalys, med en sån... alltså hokus pokus analys som är bara tillrättalagd, den hade inte fått betalt, den hade liksom fått göra om det där. För man har fått underkänt i skolan. Man får liksom inte göra så. Det försumpar ju det offentliga samtalet.
Mm, verkligen. Och det var lite intressant för han, professorn då som intervjuar Mattias Vernengo, han skrev ett blogginlägg om detta på sin blogg som heter Naked Keynesianism, som ni kan gå in och läsa där. Inlägget heter Milei and Real Wages in Argentina.
Jätteintressant. Jag tänker så här, han är ju liksom en höger liksom ikon. Han var ju med, det var ju något efter de här mötena med Trump och Musk också, så han är kanske världskänd då på något absurt sätt när han bär liksom den här motorsågen till Elon Musk liksom. Mm. Så att han är ju verkligen en del av den här rörelsen liksom. Men jag tänker så här, eftersom det här är de flesta inte helt insatta i Argentina, som ni hör, inte jag heller. Jag kommer vara det snart när jag hört din intervju här. Men liksom, är det någonting man behöver, någon förkunskap man behöver ha med sig när man lyssnar, när man liksom lutar sig tillbaka, sluter ögonen och lyssnar på den här intervjun du gör? Vad behöver man tänka på eller känna till i en svensk kontext?
Mm. Ja, det är ju lite komplext det här, och man kanske behöver kunna några saker längs vägen. Dels då den här att Argentina var ett ganska rikt land i början av 1900-talet och sen så har blivit fattigare relativt sett mot resten av världen. Kan man bra känna till. Och att de hade en president som hette Juan Perón som kom in på 40-talet och som satt i flera vändor in på 70-talet.
Han är känd för sin fru.
Han är känd för sin fru Evita Perón, precis. Och han har också format hela politiken i Argentina, så att det finns ett politiskt parti som har haft makten även efter att Perón försvann, alltså peronisterna, och de är någon sorts vänsterpopulister, ibland högerpopulister. Det är lite konstigt, det finns liksom ingen riktig motsvarighet i en europeisk kontext, men de har format landet väldigt mycket. Och han nämner president Cristina Kirchner, som är peronist, och hennes man Nestor Kirchner, som har suttit i olika vändor under
2000-talet. Och sen var hon premiärminister, tror jag, i en vända, eller satt i hon var minister,
hon var
i en vända
president
när hennes nästa i den här, för hon kunde då, de har väl regler för hur många perioder man kan sitta.
Ja.
Så hon var då liksom lite grann inga liknelseövning, men Putin som liksom vandrar, alltså hon kunde inte vara president, så då är hon inte president, utan då är någon annan. Så att innan den här Milei så var det ju en vänsterpopulist då. Alltså en populistpartiets president var president, men hon var med i regeringen.
Ja, precis, så var det.
Så att de har styrt jävligt, de här Kirchner har styrt i 20 år i stort sett. Liksom
till och från. Det har kommit andra regeringar emellan. Till exempel Macri som var mer nyliberal. Och sen så innan dess på 90-talet var det Menem som var nyliberal. Sen så på 70-80-talet så var det en militärjunta som också var nyliberal. Så att efter Perón dog så har det svängt mellan någon sorts hårdför nyliberalism, diktatur och peronism, och sen så tillbaka till en mindre hårdför sorts nyliberalism under senare år. Och Mattias Wernenga som intervjuar, han ser Milei kanske mer som en fortsättning med den här pendelrörelsen fram och tillbaka snarare än någonting helt
så
nytt.
Så det är som ett trasigt samhälle som är sådär, du vilar på segrar från fornstora dagar, som vi sjunger i den svenska nationalsången. Men det är på något sätt att Argentina, det här rika landet, ett av världens rikaste länder så här, på 1800-talets slut. Liksom, de gav bistånd till Sverige, tror jag, när vi hade liksom en hungersnöd på 1860-talet. Alltså, mycket rikt, välbärgat. Mm. Man immigrerade från Sverige till Argentina. Liksom, de som inte kom till USA, en del kom till Argentina. Alltså, den liksom, bilden av det här väldigt koloniala landet också, med mycket slavar och liksom så. Sen då liksom har de på något sätt pyst ihop, och att väljarna liksom söker efter en lösning på den här ekonomiska krisen. Och varannan gång går man till vänster och varannan gång går man till höger, och liksom båda misslyckas på något sätt, kanske med lite olika utfall, men båda misslyckas att liksom fixa ekonomin. Och det kanske också är en mycket svår uppgift när man har den här stora skulden till USA, till IMF och så.
Exakt, ja, så kan man se det. Han nyanserar lite den här bilden också av att Argentina var så rikt. Han säger att det var rikt, men det var inte utvecklat. Det är väl kanske som Saudiarabien är rikt idag, att det har liksom väldigt hög BNP per capita, men det var väldigt smalt fördelat, och det var inte så att de hade någon avancerad industri, utan det var just att de hade tur och kunde exportera vete och
gummi och sånt där också, va?
Det vet jag faktiskt inte, men de hade, det globala läget var väldigt gynnsamt för dem sent 1800-tal till 1900-tal, och sen så har det blivit mindre gynnsamt efter det, när USA blev den stora hegemonen som också säljer en massa vete och kött, men även industriprodukter som har försökt industrialisera men misslyckats till stor del. Man kanske ska veta lite också om professor Wernengos ekonomiska synsätt. Han är från Argentina. Han flydde till Brasilien under juntan och har bott utomlands till stor del. Utbildad i England och USA. Och man kan säga att han är keynesian av den gamla skolan. Cambridge keynesian. Men även väldigt inspirerad av någonting som kallas latinamerikansk strukturalism, där man tittar på hur länder i Latinamerika och även utvecklingsländer i allmänhet, hur de formas av den globala ekonomin. Och man tittar på centrum och periferi, att centrum i Europa och USA och sen så i Latinamerika periferin. Och just den här det ojämlika förhållandet mellan centrum och periferin formar vilka möjligheter utvecklingsländer har att utvecklas. Och en ekonom som han nämner ibland är Raoul Prebisch. Så det kan vara bra att känna till den sortens skola också när man lyssnar på intervjun.
Hur ser Mattias Wernengo på Javier Milleis politik? Har han liksom lyckats med att få ner inflationen, eller hur har det gått?
Han har lyckats få ner inflationen, men efter att först ha ökat på den. Så att när han devalverade peson så ökar inflationen jättemycket, och sen så har han hållit växelkursen och då har inflationen stabiliserats. Så att ja, han har fått ner den, men först efter att ha fått upp den. Och intressant som han säger också, att han har använt ganska så interventionistiska verktyg, så att han inte gjort allt det han utlovat, det här att han ville övergå till dollar. Han ville avskaffa centralbanken och låta de fria marknaderna verka. Utan han har varit ganska så framgångsrik att hålla den här nya växelkursen genom att vara väldigt interventionistisk i marknaden. Mer så än vad den tidigare regeringen var. Så att de framsteg han har gjort, menar Vernengo, beror på att han inte har hållit sig till den här nyliberala ideologin som han förespråkar.
Men då tycker jag vi rullar bandet helt enkelt. Och så får vi ses igen snart igen.
Hello, Mattias Vernengo. You are an economist, a professor of economics at Bucknell University in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. You're from Argentina, but you haven't really grown up there. You grew up in Brazil, I think, but you've spent some time working in Argentina. You've worked at the Argentinian Central Bank, if I'm not mistaken. Could you tell us just a little bit about your background and what you've been working with as an economist?
So, yeah, all that you said is absolutely correct. I grew up, so my family left in 1975, the year before the coup. I grew up in Brazil. After studying in Brazil, I came and did my PhD in the US, mostly about inflation, was supposed to be, but ended up working on the external equations of the American economy. My research remained, macroeconomics from what you can broadly call a structuralist perspective. My supervisor was formerly Lance Taylor. My co-supervisor was Wynne Godley. They work in what it's a Cambridge, Keynesian tradition and with Latin American structuralist sort of bent. So the issues I've been always working are associated to the issues of growth and development in Latin American countries, the macro sort of aspects. So these are countries that the characteristic is that we have a limit to our ability to grow because we lack foreign exchange. So dollars are difficult to come. Our patterns of specialization in trade have been, although we try to break those based on commodity exports. So that limits what you can do. And of course, it also balance of payment problems very typically lead to inflationary crisis and, currency crisis. So all of those things are things that I have studied. I continue to do those things and a little bit of the history of ideas associated to those things.
And you also have a blog called Naked Keynes, which I find
yes,
very
naked
useful.
Keynesianism. So this was because Jamie Galbraith was once, accused by Fox News in the US of teaching naked Keynesianism to students. And when I started a blog, which now it's, Jesus, it's from 2011. I said, I'm teaching naked Keynesianism too. So that ended up being the name of the blog.
Let's start with the question, Javier Milei, who is he?
Oh, well, it's an interesting thing because I think most people would think that he's an outsider. And in some, I would say irrelevant ways, he is. He's not a politician. So in that sense, he's an outsider. But and he is probably in some social ways, too, an outsider in the same sense that, say, Trump may be socially, he's not accepted by the elites in New York or wasn't. He was uncouth and from Queens. But other than that, Milei is very much entrenched in the establishment of Argentina. He worked for all of the important firms in the financial sector. He was right before being elected, even when he was a candidate, still in the payroll of one of the great media groups in Argentina. He was shown in all media shows all the time. So the idea that he came from nowhere is preposterous. He was propelled, lifted by not just the media, but some political parties. He was very close to people in the Macri administration. Macri himself, sort of played dually because he was trying to get one of the candidates in his party defeated. I think he was surprised by the actual event. But his finance minister is the same finance minister of Macri, so the finance minister back in the previous neoliberal government. His minister of deregulation was the president of the central bank in the previous government. He's the guy that was there in the crisis of 2018 when we went back to the IMF and had to ask for $56 billion. We ended up getting just 44, but that's another story. This is not different. The policies are not different than many of the policies pursued by, the previous neoliberal, the previous in 2015, 2017, but also the government of Menem, another neoliberal government back in the 90s, and the policies of the dictatorship in the 70s. So in that sense, he is the fourth neoliberal experiment in Argentina. He's part of a long tradition of neoliberal governments. He is not an outsider. He is a more mediatic, social media-driven version of the same stuff that we have had for a long time in Argentina. A fascist, not a liberal in the sense of old classical liberalism, for sure. A fascist, a free market fascist. So, you know, globally, if you, you know, it's Pinochet. You know, it's not very different than Pinochet and the Chicago Boys. That's what we have in Argentina.
Okay, so it's not so much a radical break with the past. It's more like a swing of the pendulum back to where it's been many times before.
Yes, definitely.
And some very dark places before.
Very dark place. Yes, he has been including, I should say, that's part of what I think it's problematic of this, even if, let's say, for some reason, you believe that some of these economic policies might be, you know, sort of acceptable. He comes with the baggage of a vice president that her father was in the military. She was openly defending the dictatorship. He has been, you know, suggesting that it wasn't 30,000 people that disappeared. Macri did this before, I should say, that it was just 8,000. You know, Menem had freed all of the dictators that were jailed in the 80s in Argentina. So there is a continuity. And of course, the previous one was the dictatorship itself. So they all have had all the neoliberal regimes in Argentina have had a cozy relationship with the dictatorship and pushed those ideas. I always say when people say it's not 30,000, it's 8,000, it's equivalent in the case of Argentina. I mean, the numbers are fuzzy. We don't have a perfect list of how many people disappeared, were killed by the dictatorship, tortured and killed. But it's the same thing as denying the Holocaust. It's like, well, did they kill really 6 million people? So this is what they're saying. And so this is what he's saying. And, you know, so people that may think that some of his policies are acceptable forget, you know, that that this is what is behind it. So it's not just a, you know, a technical issue. It's a political issue.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a risk that it may go down the same route with this kind of state violence?
I think state violence always exists in Latin America. You know, Brazil, for example, people tell me, "Oh, Brazil, the dictatorship was less harsh." And you know, there's a movie that might win, you know, hopefully an Oscar for Brazil, and you know, about the Brazilian dictatorship. But I always said yes. But on the other hand, Brazil has a terrible, harsh sort of violence with, you know, minorities, black people, and so on and so forth. So the repression on the working class was done in a different way than in Argentina. But that doesn't mean that there is no violence. So the violence continues. I don't think they're going to have, you know, concentration camps as we did have. And they're going to sort of torture people openly. But they're going to crack heads. They're going to come for you legally. They're doing things that are necessary to weaken unions, and so that includes, you know, some degree of violence. So sure, that's already his defense minister. She has been very harsh, and I think the protests are going to be met with violence. They have been already.
Let's talk about the historical background here. Argentina has been moving from crisis to crisis for many decades now, it seems. But it is often said that Argentina was one of the richest countries in the world back in the early 1900s, that it was a very developed and rich country, but that it's been destroyed by bad policy and populism. So could you talk a little bit about Argentina's longer economic history, this change from being a rich country to being a poor country?
Yeah, Argentina had a very high income per capita. That is absolutely correct. So if you look at the, you know, the Madison kind of series that sort of look back in past and try to recalculate income per capita and GDPs, you know, and so on and so forth, going back in time, Argentina by the late 19th century, early phase of the 20th century, has income per capita that are essentially equivalent to Western Europe, so France, Germany, and so on and so forth. But yeah. There is a great distance from having a high income per capita and being a developed country. So you know, Qatar, Saudi Arabia have very high income per capita. That doesn't make them developed countries. You know, I joke with kids when I teach that if you want to have a measure of development, you probably should look at treatment of young women. Are they have the same levels of education? You know, is there freedom? You know, this, that, and the other. That's a sign of a civilized, developed nation. Argentina had a high income per capita because at the turn of the so-called first globalization, perhaps a misnomer, but Argentina is, you know, essentially a country with very, you know, the population is relatively limited. It's a temperate climate. There is no plantation because the weather doesn't, you know, allow for that. And there is no significant mineral wealth that to be exploited. So Argentina doesn't exist during the colonial period. At this period, all of a sudden, it's a country with not too many people, lots of cows, plenty of fertile land, like as fertile as Ukraine. And so in those plains, you can produce significant amounts of wheat. And so beef and, you know, and bread came out of Argentina in that period. And the dominant country is England, an island that, you know, does not produce those things in great quantities. So Argentina has a perfect match. Not surprisingly, it's in Argentina that the idea of center periphery, you know, as producer of commodities for a center producer of manufacturers will sort of appear for the first time with Raúl Prebisch. Because we were the perfect periphery for that center. And that led to an incredible amount of wealth, so much so that income per capita in Argentina look high, but, you know, it's very rich people at the top. So Buenos Aires is a very nice city that if you look at the parts that were wealthy back in the early 1900s, you know, it was sort of, you know, we had a subway for the first place in the in Latin America to have it, probably second only to New York in the Americas, you know, and you know, it looked like in many ways it looked like a developing country, but, you know, the contrast is we have a mass of poor people, particularly at this point, significant large immigration of Europeans, of Italians, you know, descent from those immigrants, and the sort of more important issue is Argentina produced beef and you know can freeze, you know, the meat at that point. So it's beef and wheat. Whereas Germany and France, to give you the two examples I sort of use in Western Europe, they're producing steel, cars. They're at the forefront. They come up with the germ theory of disease and they have chemical industries. You know, so they're at the forefront of science and at the forefront of industry. We are not. So we're a poor country with very lucky, you know, in the so-called lottery of commodities sort of draw. And so, you know, that's the story of Argentina.
Argentina was a very good complementary match for the UK when the UK was the prime economy of the world. So
yes.
UK produced manufactured goods, Argentina produced wheat and beef. But then when the US became the hegemon, the US produced industrial goods, but also wheat and beef. So then Argentina's decline began. Is that the story?
It's very much so. You read the 49, development manifesto by Raúl Prebisch. Essentially, what he's saying is, look, these people are producing the same things we are. If we keep producing this, by the way, you know, the problem with this is when there is a boom, wages go up, you know, in the center and the periphery. But in the center, workers in industrial sector have bargaining power. They keep that. So technical progress, when it happens there, the gains, part of them at least, are retained by workers. In Latin America, the prices of commodities, we don't control them because they're commodities, so they determine international markets. When they collapse, wages collapse. And so development is for Mr. Prebisch, as it was for Adam Smith, I should say, that you have to lift the majority of the population, so the working class, so that's well-being. If you don't increase wages, there is no development. And so that's why Argentina wasn't developed. So you have to lift the living standards of everybody. And so that it's considerably more difficult if you have. So we try to industrialize. So people blame Argentina for industrializing. I mean, it's the only thing you could do. So, but we obviously, being a peripheral country, you have to import capital goods. So you have perennial, you know, problems on the balance of payment front, because exporting beef is not necessarily now central in the new world that Argentina was in the 50s and 60s. Geopolitically, peronism was not aligned with the United States, so it's at the forefront of what will be the non-aligned movement in many ways. So we didn't receive any sort of benefits from the United States opening. I mean, it would have been difficult anyways, but, you know, the Brazilian first steel mill was fully given, you know, to Vargas, to Brazil, because Brazil allowed a military base in the northeast of Brazil and it was the closest to Africa. And they needed in the Second World War to have a base to you know, fly into Africa.
And Argentina chose to be neutral during the Second World War, right? And was then boycotted by the United States.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. Perón had, was boycotted up to the 50s. You know, so
import substitution wasn't really a choice.
No, it wasn't
then.
A choice. No, of course not. It was. It happened before it was ideologically sort of defended by anybody. But Argentina did well, I should say. That's the part that. So what I want to push back a little bit. I think Argentina did relatively well. We grew fast in that period, as everybody else. So the golden age, Argentina does industrialization. It's not without merit. Argentina still does things that are meritorious. We have static satellites done totally locally. You know, it's they stop. You know, imagine for telecommunications, U.S. doesn't come and give you free satellites. So here you have them, and we have those satellites because we produce them, so that they stay for telecommunications. The Earth moves, and the satellite stays always at top of Argentina. So that's total local. The nuclear technology in Argentina, Brazil imported it all from Germany. Ours is developed in Argentina. Argentina produced 3 Nobel Prizes. So there are meritorious things that were done right with import substitution and state-led development. But we hit, as everybody else, the crisis in the 80s. And we've been, in a sense, in the new era. So in the era of reprimarization. So from the late 80s onwards, there is, with the Washington Consensus, a push to move back Latin American countries, particularly in South America, Central America, and Mexico would be, maquilas, and they produce manufactured goods, but it's, with very low value added. But in South America, very much a return to that era of the 19th century of exporting beef and wheat. This time around, we're producing, instead of beef and wheat for England, we're producing soybeans for China. But that has been our new pattern of integration into the global economy. Again, a pattern that is very problematic. In the early 2000s, just very briefly to complement, in the early 2000s, there was a push with the Kirchners, again, a Peronist government, somewhat left of center, and associated with Chavez and the pink tide in Latin America and Lula in Brazil, that they push for some degree of national autonomy and perhaps industrialization. Very difficult to do. And so that's the sort of so. But it's not like, and that period is a period of growth, of catch up, of increase of wages. The 3 periods of peak of wages in Argentina are the 50s with Perón, the 70s with Perón, and the 2000s, with the Kirchner. So development is, remember, that you lift the living conditions of the working class people. I'm not saying that all that they did or politically everything is right. I'm telling you, those are the 3 periods in which we tried development. Because if the proposition is we're going to export a lot, we're going to do well, and the subways in Buenos Aires are going to be impeccable, and people, you visit Buenos Aires and it looks like you're in Stockholm, that's not development. Development is kids are not hungry and their parents have a decent job and a decent house and they have decent education. That's development. And so that's the story. So there were attempts of development. The only 3 attempts of development, I'm sorry to say, of lifting the wage of the people at the bottom, were with the first Perón, the second Perón, and with the Kirchners. That's when wages were high in Argentina.
What would you say is the fundamental economic problem for Argentina? Is it the classical debt trap problem that a lot of developing countries have, that they have a weak currency, so they raise their interest rates, but that in turn raises the interest on the government debt, and that fuels inflation? Or how would you describe Argentina's fundamental problems now?
So the current... So the problem in general, yes, we don't have a currency. We have an external constraint. We need to import things. Contrary to what people tend to think, I'm criticized sometimes by friends in the modern money sort of theory field, which I tend to agree when they refer to the United States. Sure, fiscal policy has only significant political limits, no other in the case of the United States. But in the case of a developing country, the problem is that if the government went and said, okay, we're going to invest heavily and try to push growth and have higher wages and expand the domestic market. The problem is that developing countries, because they are peripheral, because we import a lot of intermediary goods, so we're behind in the technology, and because we have to import capital goods, those things inevitably, and some of the consumption goods, if people want iPhones, which in Argentina people wanted those things, when I was in the central bank, and everybody, oh, you have an iPhone, because I had brought it from the US. Everybody's, oh, the iPhone, the patterns of consumption, you're in trouble. Why? Because once the economy grows and people have better incomes, imports go up and you don't have enough exports to pay for the imports and for you know, the debt that you might have in foreign currency. And you always have some debt in foreign currency because you're an importer of technology and intermediary goods and all of those things. So those things do matter. So in our current version of this problem, what happened is that after the 2008 global financial crisis, most developing countries, even a little bit before, were accumulating large amounts of dollar reserves. And Argentina made a strategic mistake of not accumulating reserves. And that makes you very vulnerable to whatever happens, because your exchange rate, you know, if you don't have, central bank doesn't have enough dollars to mitigate the depreciation of the currency. The depreciation of the currency does two things. It increases the price of imported goods, part and parcel of this. But by increasing the price of imported goods, it reduces the purchasing power of wages and reduces wages. And when they do that, they reduce the level of activity in the economy. So the economy enters a recession, and that resolves the balance of payment problem. Why? Because the recession, people import less, you need to produce less. And so the problems are solved. Not the depreciation changing the price, and now you can export more and import less because of the price. The exports of Argentina are not affected by our exchange rate. The Chinese will buy, you know, the price is in dollars, and so we sell it in the same price to the Chinese who buy it anyway. So the exchange rate, what it does is changes the remuneration in pesos of the exporters of soybean. So when the exchange rate depreciates, you get more pesos for your soybean, but you don't export more. The Chinese don't need more, you know, just because you change your exchange rate. So it doesn't help you in that way. It helps you because people have less money to spend, wages, and it causes a recession. But the other thing is the inflation. And if you have, as we had, for example, with the Kirchners and with the previous government in which Cristina was vice president with Alberto Fernandez, it turned out to be a very sort of flawed government. You know, I'm not necessarily defending everything they did, but the depreciation in a government that has a constituency in the trade unions will have to give wage increases. And so once you have wage increases, you have that the depreciation now has been sort of eaten by prices went up in Argentina. So things are again more expensive. So you have more depreciation. And so you have a spiral. So Argentina in the last 15 years, including with the neoliberal government that was before, with the same team that Milei has, didn't manage to do that. And I should say, Cristina imposed, when the things started to get complicated in 2011, the capital controls. The previous government in 2016, they entered in December 2015. In 2016, very early, they eliminated the capital controls. By 2018, the crisis, the capital flight was so big and they didn't have reserves. This is the neoliberal government. The finance minister was the same. The president of the central bank is his current minister of deregulation. What happened is they had to go to the IMF and they reimposed, with authorization of the IMF, capital controls. So this crisis, which we're still living, started, fair enough, in 2011 when we started to have external balance of payment problems. And that comes from the 2008-09 sort of crisis. But they became acute during the neoliberal government of Macri with the same people that are here that already received 40-something billion dollars from the IMF and are, you know, apparently going to receive another 10 billion from the same IMF to, again, probably make a disaster with the Argentinian economy.
So what has Milei done since he came into power? Has he reduced inflation?
Well, in a sense, he did. So he first accelerated inflation and then he reduced inflation. So the inflation, for these reasons that I suggested, was accelerating. It was at about 3-4% per month for most of the Alberto Fernandez presidency. So from 2019 to 2023, and they did have four very bad years of economy. That, you know, the external sector was really in difficulties because of droughts associated to climate change, and so the exports sort of shrank. We have the pandemic. Again, there might be discussions of what they did, didn't do, but the economy obviously tanked and it recovered. They tried to get recovered reasonably well, but, you know, Argentina stagnated since 2011, I should say. And inflation, you know, was, as I said, 3-4% per month. But the reserves were sort of dwindling and very low. And so...
Dollar reserves, you mean?
The foreign reserves in the central bank. So yeah. Dollars. We didn't have enough dollars. And so this implied that we were, the IMF had sort of postponed payments, and we had renegotiated with Martin Guzman, was the finance minister, this pull of Joe Stiglitz, and they've been pushing that. And then by the last year, when Massa, who was going to be the candidate, the government candidate for the presidency, a liberal in the old sense of free market sort of Peronist. So not all Peronists were, it's contrary to what people think on the left. So it's a strange coalition. So he was forced to depreciate the currency when he was finance minister, and that of course had an effect on the election. So inflation at that point with him accelerates. It goes to 6, 8, and after his depreciation, it goes up to, in the last month of the Alberto Fernandez presidency, to 12%. Milei, when he enters, the first thing he does is he depreciates the currency by 50%, or devalues by 50%, I should say. It's an increase of, he doubles the price of dollars in pesos. So it goes from 400 pesos per dollar to about 800 pesos per dollar. That accelerates inflation to 25% per month. And so when he gets in the first month of Milei, inflation is 25% per month. And real wages sort of, which were falling, of course, because of the acceleration of inflation, they take a huge tumble at that point. That's when they sort of take a significant tumble. And what Milei does next, it's sort of interesting because, he had promised what? I'm going to, like Macri in 2016, I'm going to eliminate capital controls. I'm going to, allow the free movement of money in and out of the country. And I'm going to do a fiscal adjustment that would sort of control inflation. And confidence will come back, and investors will come back, and we're going to grow and stabilize because of the confidence in markets and so on and so on. So what he proceeds to do is something slightly different. On the inflation front first, he does not eliminate the capital controls. He had even promised dollarization. So I'm going to eliminate capital controls, and perhaps we're going to go into a dollarized economy. But he doesn't eliminate capital controls. He keeps them in place. And then he starts devaluing the official rate at 2%. And when the gap between the market, so-called blue exchange rate, which is the market rate in Argentina, it starts to increase. So this says that the official depreciation of 2% is not enough, and people are in the black parallel market. They are going and buying dollars. And so the price of the dollar is sort of moving significantly from the official rate. So the gap between the parallel and the marketing and the official rate, it's in what we call in Argentina the caves. So there are little sort of hidden places in which you can go and buy dollars hidden. So it's not official. It's supposedly legal and so on and so forth. But they're open. Everybody knows. If you go downtown Buenos Aires, there are people telling you the price of the dollar in the street, and so you can buy it at the... So intervening in that market, he has held, the exchange rate. And by holding the exchange rate and, taking a tumble on wages, he held inflation. So inflation has come down. So he has done a good job of holding inflation by not doing anything of the things he promised and by being very alternative in his interpretation of, inflation. So what he's saying is inflation, by doing this, he's telling inflation is caused by the external problem, the lack of reserves, the lack of dollars, and the need to hold exchange rate and hold the spiral between wages and exchange rates that drove inflation. So he's holding that. So what did the fiscal adjustment that he is doing do for the economy? So he came and cut a lot of spending. So fundamentally, he cut, for example, the pensions to the elderly. So pensions have taken a huge tumble. So a lot of this adjustment has been done on the backs of the elderly. He cut the payments of public servants. And he stopped transfers to provinces. And he also made several things that, he decided not. So investment disappeared. So things that were, Argentina was exporting satellites, nuclear reactors, those things, those halted all the funding from the government to those things. Actually, a terrible kind of thing, because that's the sort of thing that would lead to exports that are not dependent on prices of international markets, its actual development, its Argentinian technology. So he cut all of that to the bone. There is no money for all of those things. And some of the cuts are, frankly, unsustainable. So he does have a short-term, sort of adjustment. But, if for example, the distributors of electricity, they buy the electricity from these producers. But if you don't pay them, of course, at some point they will stop providing the electricity. So what's happening is he didn't pay for the bills, but at some point he will have to pay. So there is a an element in the fiscal adjustment that it's gimmicky, that it's, you know, it's an accounting, you know, sort of trick in which he's actually going to have to spend some of this money. He's going to have to give money to the provinces. He cannot starve to death the pensioners. So at some point he will have to do something about that. And either will be a political problem because people will be in the streets, or be a question of how he allocates or then spends them and so on and so forth. And, you know, we'll be back to the deficit sort of zone. I think that's part of the story. So what it did is that the economy somewhat tumbled. So if you take away the agricultural sector that has been booming, it's been booming simply because we had a good year. After four terrible years of droughts, all of a sudden, you know, it rained. And so we have a boom. And so the exports are doing pretty well. And so if you take away that, the economy tumbled at least 4% in the, you know, in the first year. Of course, when you get the whole thing and you add the agricultural sector, which in Argentina is huge and very important, it's probably, you know, a recession of 1%. But he accelerated that sort of fall. And of course, wages now, because he's holding the exchange rate, wages are recovering, but they're recovering from a very low sort of level. And that has allowed a little bit of recovery of consumption, and that has allowed a little bit of a recovery of the economy, but the economy is still below what the previous peak. So people say, oh, the economy is out of a recession. No, it's not. I mean, the economy is only out of a recession. I mean, people say, oh, you're growing again. You're growing again. You're starting the recovery. To be out of the recession, you have to be above the previous peak. You know, if there are more people unemployed and more people, you know, and the output is below what you used to have, you're not out of the recession, buddy. You are just starting the recovery. So the recovery has started. Is it sustainable? Well, we'll see. I mean, is it sustainable if you keep doing a fiscal adjustment like this one? It's fully dependent on the external sector? Perhaps not. And so it's to be seen. So the macroeconomy is in better shape now than it was in the last year. It has to deal with some of the problems he generated, the acceleration of inflation, and with the humongous recession that he accelerated. But from whether he got the economy into at the beginning, it's in a better place. And so people are glowing and he's fantastic and he's resolved the problems. He resolved some of the problems he created. He has not resolved the problems of Argentina. And yeah, and there are many other sort of significant problems ahead. So we'll see. I mean, even with the support of the IMF and now with Trump in the White House, who is an ally, it's not altogether clear that the situation in Argentina is rosy and the future is a path to development again, as he says, you know.
What are the consequences of Javier Milei's policies?
I wrote a little thing in Spanish for a journal that is edited by a think tank that was, I think, 50, 60 years old, that was edited by the president of the central bank when I was there. And part of what I said is, you know, people tend to see some of these policies and Menem and, you know, the four neoliberal projects as failures. So they're failures because they didn't promote what they tell you at the beginning. We're going to have Argentina, by doing these liberal policies, a very developed country. We're going to be like the United States, like, you know, Switzerland or whatever it is. The problem is that, you know, with that is that you think, well, they failed, sure. But, you know, you have to believe that Milei may very well think these things because he's not, I think, altogether up there functional. But, you know, that's another story. But, you know, the people that are behind him, like Federico Sturzenegger, whose father was in previous governments, and it's sort of an intelligent man and, you know, PhD at whatever pen of the Argentinian sort of upper middle class elites. And, you know, so he knows what he's doing. You know, I tend to see it not as an accident. I tend to see that the objectives are being obtained. So contrary to what people think, this is a success. What they're doing is, if you are, you know, Argentina is a producer of soybeans. If you're a producer of, you know, and have some stake in the Argentinian sort of competitive sort of markets, which is soybeans, we're going to be exporting lithium, we're going to be, you know, exporting natural gas. We have those things in quantities. We had finished in the previous government a gasoduct. We're going to have more of that and finish it perhaps. It's a very nice place to be. You know, you as they said, you live in Buenos Aires and the nice parts are okay. So the project is a project of a lot of inequality, of maintaining the specialization that now it's 40 years old. It was done by the military and it's still in place. That the neoliberal model was never broken. We tried to have higher wages, tried to reindustrialize. We kept pockets. He's just coming to destroy more of those pockets. Well, that's why he's cutting the funding to firms that produce satellites and nuclear reactors and cutting the funding for research and development, because you don't need those guys. You need a few lawyers, perhaps a few economists with PhDs from the good, reputable universities in the U.S. to tell you that the liberal adjustment is good and it's good for everybody, although, you know, it's not good for everybody, and we know that. And, you know, and they repeat and parrot those things, and then things fail. So, oh, no, we failed. And even when the money comes in and the IMF and a good money, you know, chunk of the money goes out, Argentinians, when I say Argentinians, it's the elite. It's, you know, it's the very few people at the top that have more or less the amount of our external debt, something to the tune of $250, $300 billion in assets outside of the country. So for those folks, this government is great. For the process of development, so if we're thinking we need to lift the work, you know, the living conditions and the well-being of the people at the bottom, this is a disgrace. You know, a journalist from England asked me about, well, but he's not a populist, he is a liberal. So, you know, there are certain things that come with that, freedoms that perhaps people didn't have. And that's a lie. So that's the other thing with concerns with, immigration, so that he has the same thing. He's been harsh on immigration. And in the case of Argentina, that comes also. People don't tend to understand. That comes with an ethnicity sort of. So he is against the what? The Paraguayans, the Bolivians, the Peruvians. That are coming into society, and they're, you know, it's the same discourse. Macri in the previous government wanted to do a wall. So they're very Trumpist. The difference is that Trump has a nationalist bend in terms of the economics, and they don't. But that's because the United States does have a military industrial complex. Argentina doesn't. And so it's just, but it's a populist government of the right. He tried to eliminate this week femicide as a crime. He said that there is no reason to have a different type of crime for the killing of women for being women. I says, yeah, femicide is such a terrible word. That's why we don't have a word for people that kill themselves. So we shouldn't use suicide. So of course there is femicide, and women are killed, you know, for gender issues, you know, just for being women. There is violence against trans people and so on and so forth. He wants to push back against abortion. So a liberal in the sense of, you know, you have your individual freedom atop of everything wouldn't come for abortion and those rights of minorities. And so he's very much on the repressive end. And although he's not religious per se, he has some sort of the religious sort of concern with what people do in their bedrooms and their private lives. So he's a right-wing populist. He's very dangerous, not just for the economy of Argentina. I mean, socially, that's the other thing. It brings back issues of the dictatorship, a positive revaluation of the legacy of a very dark, you know, murderous, genocidal dictatorship. So that's the social context of this. It's very dark. He's very dark. He's a figure that just last week at Davos, he came in favor of Orban, of Trump, of, you know, Bolsonaro, of all sort of very dark figures some openly fascist in the world economy. He also has a very direct connection with Elon Musk, as Mr. Trump does too. So
I have to ask, how did the left lose to this guy? What did they do wrong, do you think?
How much time do we have? Because, you know, this is, I mean, the left doesn't need much help. You know, it's the old joke of Monty Python. You know, it's we're always divided in fratricidal sort of groups. I think we did not control inflation. Since 2011, we've been unable to bring growth and higher wages. It's a world that has been more complicated. It happened in places that manage things better, like Brazil. Still, there was a backlash and a right wing sort of movement. And I shouldn't diminish the role of the United States in that and the example of Trump. But certainly the left in Argentina is responsible for this defeat. It's responsible for not having a project of development and stabilization that actually worked. And so I would say in part, the stabilization, we failed to accumulate reserves that would have required higher interest rates during a period there to accumulate those reserves. So you have to have an interest rate that it's higher than the foreign interest rate plus the expected depreciation. If you allow the exchange rate to completely go on, so you don't accumulate reserves, which require that you have interest rates higher, and people say, you know what, interest rates are so high, that are higher than the depreciation of the peso, and hence I'm going to be better off if I hold pesos. So the reason for why Argentina was somewhat dollarized is acceded to the policies of the left for a long period. Not just the left, the right-wingers also did that. But the left was incapable of, you know, Lula did accumulate reserves. Lula had very high interest rates for a long while. In 2019, I wrote for Página 12, one of the most popular and left-of-center newspapers in Buenos Aires. I said, a Brazilian solution. And I was telling the Alberto Fernández government, in which I knew people, you know, if you want to survive, what you'll need to do is to have higher interest rates to accumulate reserves first. And actually, you can have actually a more lax fiscal policy because, you know, with the appreciation of the peso and whatnot, you know, if we have an external front that it's not too terrible and we're able to renegotiate with the IMF, which they were, the IMF was didn't want Argentina to default at that point, we would have been able not to grow fast. Argentina cannot grow 7-8%, but, you know, but growth of 2-3% with wages increasing mildly and, you know, slowly getting in the right direction. So those things were possible. There's nobody on the left with that discourse in the economy. There are all sorts of other issues, you know, the normal issues of politics. I'm hopeful that there are, so there is a break within Peronism between Cristina and her ex-finance minister. He's the governor of Buenos Aires. He's the only one that won in December of 2023, a significant name on the left of Peronism that won his election, was re-elected governor of Buenos Aires, Axel Kicillof. I think he has a chance to become the, you know, face of the left. And if Milei sort of gets us into a crisis, which I think not necessarily tomorrow, not necessarily by the end of the year, but it's not impossible, even with IMF support and all of that, to happen before the next election in 2027, there might be a chance of the left coming back. So it's not hopeless politically, but the left obviously has to have a discourse that, as I would say in the U.S., failed to have a discourse that gives hope to people. So you have to say, we're going to be able to increase your wages, improve the quality of health, we're going to be able to provide jobs, that kind of stuff. And it's not an Argentinian failure. There has been, in many places, failures of the left to hold. Lula won in 2022. So in Mexico, again, with many problems, and I don't go into all of those, but, you know, AMLO certainly got his candidate, Sheinbaum, elected. So the idea that the left is done and over, I think it's, you know, it's like Mark Twain's death. It's perhaps it's premature.
Mm. And it seems like if the fundamental problem is that dollars are so scarce, is there any chance that a government could ration dollars to only supply dollars or channel dollars toward importing important technology, sort of like Japan did in the 50s and 60s. Is that something that could happen in Argentina?
Yes, we did that. And, you know, it was being done at the end. I mean, that's the thing I always say. People forget when dollars are so scarce as they are in Argentina, you're already doing that. You're already sort of managing the dollars you have because, you know, you there are certain things that without those, the economy doesn't work. And so unless you manage the limited resources you have, you're in trouble. So that's perfectly doable. We have the experience of doing it. We've done it. We've done it even recently. So I don't think that would be a problem at all.
Thank you very much. One last question. Do you have any predictions about the future?
My predictions are, you know, probably all going to be wrong. So I think that he has a good chance. You know, I said my nightmare is that he would succeed in stabilizing the economy. So I think if the IMF gives him the $10 billion that, you know, some people in the press in Argentina suggest that he will be able to do that. He might win the midterm elections this October, and that would strengthen his hand in Congress. He will be able to pass some of the reforms that have been very hurtful for development in Argentina. I think that he might even try to dollarize. If those things happen, I would suggest to you eventually, though, I think things will, I mean, Argentina has, if exports keep booming, he'll be able to pay and whatnot. This might explode in somebody else's hands, you know, later on. So that would be a dark prediction. But if he does half of that, it's still very dark. So I think that's a possible scenario of what happens. So it's in that sense, a complicated situation. He may also have the crisis before the 2027 election, as I said, then we have a left of center government in place. But then, you know, it's not like what it comes with a left of center government is easy. So what comes is a very hard, years of reconstruction of a devastated sort of project in a country that it's essentially not very different than the country that, you know, we had in the 19th century.
Thank you very much, Matthias Venengo.
Thank you.
Du lyssnar alltså till Starta pressarna, en podd från Aftonbladets ledarsida om ekonomi och politik. Fortsätt mejla in dina frågor och synpunkter och kanske önskemål om framtida poddar till startapressarna@katalys.org. Swisha in stöd till vår kampanj som börjar i höst om att stoppa vinster i välfärden. Jag tror personligen att valet 2026 kommer bli en folkomröstning om vinst i välfärden. Katalys kommer vara de som ser till att detta helt enkelt blir ett avslutat kapitel. Så swisha in, du hittar allt det på katalys.se. Allt stöd är välkommet. Och glöm inte att ekonomi är politik, inget annat.
Du har lyssnat på en podcast från Aftonbladet. Ansvarig utgivare är Lotta Folker.